Hello, hello. Welcome to the Tuesday night discussion group for December the 10th, 2013. We're proud to be back tonight discussing Steve Ozenich's The Great Pain Deception. We'll be on chapters 20 and 21 tonight. Chapter 20 is called Neurosis, Affectional Needs Gone Haywire. And chapter 21 that we'll be discussing is Highly Sensitive People. I think this is going to be really good because it's going to bring out a lot of what we've all been through. Plus, it's going to bring out answers to these personality traits and these things we're just born with, and how to make things better. So, with that being said, I want to say the main disclaimer before we start. I do need to remind everyone that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. If you have a medical concern, you should see a properly licensed physician, or we'd recommend a TMS physician. Okay, with that being said, we got the summary to chapter 20, and I'm going to hand it off to our great summarizer, Bruce MC.
Okay, well, to be brief, in this chapter, what Steve Ozenich tries to do is to link TMS personality traits with neurosis, as defined by the two authorities that he leans on here or cites, Carl Gustav Jung, especially in analytical psychology, its theory and practice, and then on Carnegie, who is the father, I was going to say, but rather the mother of feminist psychiatry, because she rejected Freud's theory of penis envy. There's a whole long story about that in her personal biography. But she comes up with, she says that neurotic traits come from environment. Well, Steve gives a definition of neurosis on the second page of the chapter, which I'll read quickly. Neurosis is merely a need for affection gone haywire. Since everyone needs affection in some form, the severity of the neurosis is in the degree of need for affection and approval. The normal individual just tries to survive and cope, while the neurotic, quote, quoting Jung here, makes the need to control central to her existence. The true neurotic has a greater need for power, control, exploitation, admiration, achievement, independence, perfectionism, and unassailability. And Steve says that the T-type, the TMSer, can be borderline neurotic under this definition if the need for control is too central. What Horney says is that what causes neurotic traits in children is not like the Oedipal complex or the Electra complex, but rather parental apathy or verbal criticism, which results in, oh, three basic coping strategies: compliance, and Steve thinks this is the more common form among TMSers, or aggression. Children's first reaction to parental indifference is anger or basic hostility. This is somewhat rare because these people are rebels, while most type Ts are self-abusive and compliant. And then there's withdrawal. He gives some cautionary parables about the way this these traits can work themselves out, mystic traits. And that's the chapter in a nutshell, is Steve trying to relate TMS personality traits with neurosis as defined by Jung and Horney. So can we go from there?
Okay, could you rephrase that last, or not rephrase it, but say that last sentence one more time?
What that that Steve is trying to link TMS personality traits with personality traits of neurotics as described by Jung and Horney. And one thing he says, that compliance, he thinks, this coping strategy is the more common form among TMSers. This is the transcortification of others due to overpowering need for acceptance from them. This includes the self-effacing solution, the need for affection and approval, which is the indiscriminate need to to both please others and be liked by them at the same time. Now, I think that what's central here is his concept of transcodification, because that's the way you solve these problems, according to him. He says the term transcodify stems from the most basic need to reduce the pain of early separation through complying, becoming perfect by falling in line, or rebelling, becoming antagonistic, gain attention, or self-sufficiency, becoming perfect through the fervent desire to be independent. So that's how he ties his central concept of transcodification into Horney's three categories, three coping categories that she defines as fundamentally neurotic. So we can go from there, can't we?
Yeah. And does anybody want to comment on what Bruce just said before I do? Okay. Bruce, you mentioned something about Steve's trying to make the connection, which I think he does a real good job, you know, making the connection between the neurotics and the TMSers, you know. And he basically does say here on page 236, compliance trait is the closest to the TMSer. He's got here the need for affection and approval. The need to both please others and be liked by them, the need for a partner, for someone else to take over one's life, encompassing the idea that love will solve all one's problems, and the neurotic need to restrict one's life unto narrow borders, including being undemanding, satisfied with little, and inconspicuous.
Okay.
Yeah. Inconspicuous. Okay. With that being said there, I look down here and I can see myself in about six of those. Up to a couple years ago, I can see myself in about six of those. I don't understand the need to restrict one's life. Okay. The need for somebody else to run your life. Is that what he's saying there?
Yeah, I never, in that one wasn't part? Didn't Tennis Tom talk about codependency last time? And I was struck by how this coping strategy tied so nicely, was so close to codependency in a way. It's like the roots of codependency.
Okay. So it's codependency. Okay. Well, with me, I remember, he says for someone else to take over one's life. For someone else to take over one's life. So you say that's codependency, right?
Yeah, looking around for someone to be enslaved to, you know, the terrible, the white lady, you know, all that stuff in Robert Graves.
I never experienced that, but has anybody else on the phone experienced anything to like that?
I guess a lot of guys prostrate themselves before goddesses, don't they?
Yeah.
Until they learn better.
Yeah. These other ones here, though, encompassing the idea that love will solve all one's problems. That wasn't me. Is that anybody else that might be on the phone here? Encompassing the idea that love will solve all one's problems? Or
no,
thinking
that's silly.
That's the solution? Okay. And the neurotic need to restrict one's life into narrow borders. Now, when I got right before, you know, I had the pain while I was going through it, and the whole time I was in the pain, I was doing that. I was restricting my borders. I was undemanding. I was satisfied with little, and I was, and I don't know what that other word means, but I know I was those last four. You know, I was shy and cornered off to myself, and really just wanted to be, you know, self, what do you call it? Self-contained, where I can just take care of everything by myself, you know?
And independent.
Independent. And cutting myself off basically from relationship. And and I soon found out that that wasn't doing nothing but causing more pain. So has anybody got any stories like that where, you know, leading up before you found out about TMS, you might have been going through this where you was cutting yourself off from other people. And soon enough, you found out that those borders you was putting up was basically causing you stress, tension, and pain.
Yeah. I think we've all felt that.
Yeah, I think everybody's been through that. But, you know, that's a TMS trait, I know.
It was interesting when you were talking about codependency, because you can definitely, like, the idea of codependency seems like you're really trying to tricordify, you're trying to pull people closer, you're trying to make that connection because you didn't have it. Definitely heard it a lot in there. It was just kind of interesting connecting that from last week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I noticed when I read it. Yeah. Tennis Tom. You work with these people, don't you? You're an A.
Codependent tennis players. Yeah, there's a lot of them out there. It's called doubles. Most tennis is doubles.
Yeah. And that's like pairs and fingers.
The beauty of it is when you play doubles, you can always blame your partner when you lose. Yeah, partner's fault. But one thing that Steve-O keeps emphasizing to get you out of TMS is tricordification or relationships. He keeps, in those two chapters, I think maybe three, four times at least, he mentioned the importance of being in a good, I guess, good relationships versus codependent ones. So that's one thing he's emphasized.
It seems just like when you're in pain, though, you feel like you want to isolate yourself and go live in a cave like an animal when it's hurt. I wonder how much of that is instinctive and has to do with self-preservation. When you're vulnerable, or is it because you think you deserve the pain and you're making yourself me?
He puts a lot of emphasis on what happened before you can remember anything that happened. In the last chapter, he emphasizes, he mentioned things that happened before you were born. So I don't think anyone can remember anything before, 2 years old, maybe? Is that a... something like that. So what are you going to do about it? You had no control over that. So I think it's just accepting, hey, get over it. It wasn't your fault. You're a little kid. And move on. And it's the same for everybody. Isn't it? I mean, he was talking about if you're a single child and you had a praise heaped on you, then that's even a bigger problem if you had siblings and had to share it. So he said if you had four siblings and you had the pain of separation four times, but then if you were an only child, then that was bad. So it's just like all I can say is it's part of the human condition.
Yeah.
And the point that Steve-O teaches is all you can do is understand it and get over it and move on.
But Hornet's big contribution, as I see it from just glancing over her work, is that she shifted the stage away from these Freudian paradigms like the Oedipal complex or the Electra complex, just plain back into the environment that a child inhabits. When he or she develops these coping strategies, compliance, aggression, withdrawal, it's basically the way you interact with your parents, you know, parental apathy, verbal criticism, abuse or neglect. It's not like you've got an Oedipal complex and then this is going to determine all of your neuroses forevermore, unless you resolve it some way. It's real simple stuff. Just being criticized as a kid, then you withdraw inward. Or you become aggressive, or you comply, you bow down. and accepted probably rather resentfully at some one level, I'm sure.
Does that make sense, Tom?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, Horne did quite a bit, didn't she, with that shift.
That's good stuff.
Oh, yeah. Anybody else got anything to say on that?
I guess I do.
Okay.
Well, does anyone else have something to say on that topic? And then I got a new topic I kind of wanted to bring in.
Okay.
Go ahead, Forrest.
I was just really glad that Tennis Tom brought up trichordification and its role in the book. It reminded me of the quote that he opens the book with. Says, life is relationship. Life is, I thought maybe it's a good time to pull it in, because throughout the book, you know, he introduces the idea of trichordification really early on, and it does seem to be a theme uniting the entire book. And so maybe now is a time to revisit that quote. He says, life is relationship. Life is pulling the other person back to you, pulling them toward your heart, pulling the separated hearts back together that once beat as one. Everyone needs to be heard in life, to be joined, their stories told, a relationship cannot survive. So I just thought it was interesting that it seems like in these chapters, he's really talking and introducing this more seriously and more comprehensively. He goes on and says nearer to the end, the human mind will resort to infinite possibilities in order to gain an advantage in the effort to fulfill this most basic need, to pull the other back to themselves, closing any separation in order to avoid the fear of isolation once again. Happiness surrounds the need for measured approval, unrequited self-acceptance, and the avoidance of rejection, as self, with a capital S, becomes unto itself. Through the pain of each separation, each new separation comes a rebirth. So it's just, you know, putting the centrality in his ideas of connection and attachment, and then at the very end talking about, you know, how from pain can come rebirth.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Relationship. So without relationship, you could bring a relationship. It sums up everything you need to know to pretty much get anywhere you want to in life. Wow. So many of us, you know, stay at home and we get in pain, and next thing you know, we're telling the, you know, our family not to come by. We don't feel well this week. And then the next week we're telling other friends not to come by, and before you know it, we're cutting off relationships and we're going in a different direction, and what we have to do is get those relationships, let them come over, let them talk to you, let them be your friends, let them come over so you can vent a little bit or whatever it might be. Stay in those relationships, don't lose those relationships, because they're a healing factor, they're a strong healing factor. Would you agree, Forrest?
Well, sure, but as you were saying that, I was reminded of that post that Bruce brought up earlier on, before the recording started, of introverts. What happens if you're an introvert? What if you just want your peace and quiet? How does that fit in?
Well, according to this book here, I'm an introvert. But let me tell you something. Without relationship, that introvert would have had me stay in pain. So if some people's personality is just an introvert, and they just take it as, I'm just this way and I really don't want to see nobody, I go and get my energy back through being alone, but at the same time, I get energy by being around other people too. So I don't know.
It's like Billy
really
Idol.
I'm an introvert, but
every dreamer needs a home.
There you go. I think it works both ways, Forrest. I think it works both ways. Even if you're an introvert, I know you still need a relationship, right?
Absolutely.
I think so.
So it's just a balance within the individual. But I'm an introvert, believe it or not, and I love being.
I don't believe it.
But I gotta get out there and meet some people sometimes, talk to people.
Yeah.
You know, just life.
That's good. You know, that balance. I love the way you brought the word balance in, because we all need that. And that's what it does, you know, being in, if you are an introvert, you get away by your time for the solitude, get yourself where you need to be, and then you go back out there and, you know, get back in relationship with life again and become who you want to be.
Yeah.
If you hold back, it's just going to build up tension, is it not, Forrest?
Yeah, but I mean, to some degree, so I'm definitely an introvert. Like, I'm not shy, but I think I gain a lot of energy from being on my own. And I think the solution to that, what might look like a contradiction between introverts getting energy from being alone and everyone needing connection, I think is that for an introvert, you can be with people, but not necessarily be gabbering, you know, talking all the time. You know, you can be, it's a quieter sort of togetherness. I think that works for a lot of people.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I got a sister like that she's, no matter what we do, where we go, she's always wanting to talk. She's always wanting to be around people all the time. I don't never see a time that she gets off to herself. So I know she's a full-blown extrovert. And I can see the difference with what Forrest said. I can see where I like to get in and, you know, get the things I got to do down with no interruption. But then when I want to go out and do, you know, have my relationship with life, then I'll go out and do that. But in the past, what created a lot of my pain, I pretty much know, is that when I did get done with all the, you know, the solitude stuff, the things that I got to do at home, I wouldn't go out and, you know, free up the child on the inside and let him enjoy himself. So, yeah, it works both ways, and it's a balance, like Enjoy said. I like that. This is turning out to be a great, great discussion. Y'all keep bringing up these ideas, because this is awesome. Anybody else want to say anything on what we're talking about? Introvert.
Well, this little parable, I was interested in this little parable of Little Miss Perfect that he weaves into his, that Steve weaves into his narrative. And I thought it was interesting the connection Steve makes between her desire to succeed, the way he classifies it as an affectional need. You know, this is a nice little story about Danielle Amie, who was defined by the other women in the golf competition she was in for a slot on the LPGA tour as Little Miss Perfect, always primping in front of the mirror and hogging the ladies' room so they couldn't get in there. Well, she won, but not by much, and Steve seems to disparage her talents a little bit. But when she was actually scheduled to go play on the LPGA tour, she developed back pain and went home to see her doctor. Steve says that Danielle had been overstimulated from the pressure she was placing on herself in order to succeed. And then he says that's an affectional need. The pain arrives to hide her anxiety and to control a situation where she may be criticized, redirecting her mind's eye away from a panicky side of herself that superego wishes to remain hidden. I wonder how he defines the desire to succeed as an affectional need. Is that part of this transcodification process? Is that when it's misdirected? She's actually aching for acceptance by being perfect.
Can you be perfect when you're an amateur on a professional tour? You know, you're not going to measure up. You're not going to be perfect. So she panicked and she developed TMS and home she went.
And so since she couldn't be the best golfer, then she wanted to be the cutest girl on the tour, constantly messing with her image and trying to
win.
Well, it was a measure of her insecurity, wasn't it, all the primping time?
Yeah.
I just thought that was an interesting little tale.
Well, and it reminds me very much of Pathways to Pain Relief. And, you know, there you have two psychoanalysts. I'm sure they know their Hornet very well. And they're talking about, you know, why do we become perfectionist? And if I remember correctly, they also tied it back to childhood and childhood separation, childhood fear of rejection, and perfectionism there was a defense against fear of rejection. So I think it fits in very well with Steve.
So Danielle, Amy E. was really afraid of being rejected in that situation, wasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so maybe maybe the fear or the anxiety, the sensitivity develops when you're very young from fear of rejection, fear of disconnection, and let on just any sort of anxiety can trigger that can trigger that fear. So when you're young, you decide that you have to be perfect so that you aren't abandoned. And then later on, when you find yourself not being perfect, then you get really anxious and you get TMS, even though you know that you don't, at the later age, you know that you don't have to be perfect in order to not be abandoned. But you still feel like you have to be perfect. Those older parts of the brain, the timeless unconscious still has that terror.
I can think of a episode when I was about 10 years old going to the kiddies matinee where you got tickets, a flyer. And well, my mother took them out of the flyer and gave them to me. And I was to walk over there across town to the theater. And I was carrying the tickets. Well, I went up to the entrance and I showed the tickets to the girl in the booth of the theater, and she nodded. And I felt she was rejecting me and saying I couldn't go in automatically, a knee-jerk reaction. So I went all the way back home and whined to my mother that the girl had told me to go away.
Oh, no.
And it was obviously rejection, fear of rejection, or feeling like I was rejected automatically, born to lose, you know, like the song. And you can see how people walk around all the time with those kind of little memes in their brain that they picked up. Steve's word. This recalled that episode to me.
Interesting.
When all she was doing was telling me to go into the theater.
Yeah.
And my mother called, and then she called. The girl called back and said, "He went away. We didn't want him to go away."
I was just about to graduate from high school. I may have told this story before. If I have, I'm sorry, but I was just about to graduate from high school, and I went to the biggest newspaper in the province of BC. And I made an appointment with the city editor, and I marched in and I showed him my clippings and stuff. And he read them over and he said, "Well, you know, we usually only hire university graduates." And I said, "Yeah, well, I'm going to do that, but I want to work at the same time." And he said, "Okay, when I've got an opening, I'll hire you." And I thought, "Oh, rejected." And I actually went to Ontario and became something else entirely. Isn't that ridiculous? I mean, just so expecting that if things aren't going to work out for you, that you don't recognize it when he hits you on the head.
Yeah, we already jumped to these conclusions that, you know, well, they're already going to give it to somebody else, or they ain't going to think I'm good enough, or you know, you already jumped to these conclusions that you're going to be criticized and you can't handle that, you know, and then on top of that, that you might not be good enough. And I think I'm pretty sure this is what this girl went through here. Basically the same thing that Enjoy just got done saying. How many times have we backed out of situations that could have got us ahead in life? Because we thought we weren't good enough. Because we thought, even though everybody else had done told us, "Hey, you can do this. I know you can," but because we thought we wasn't good enough, or because we thought we was gonna get in there and then fail. How many times have we backed out, you know, in the past from doing things that we really wanted to do, and we was really blessed to do it? The thing was, we had this feeling on inside that, what if I mess up? What if somebody criticizes me? This is what we're talking about. We want to get this out so that everybody can understand that you can take back control of that part of you that does that, you know, like the woman again that Bruce brought up. Her name's Amy, or her last name's Amy. Is that right, Bruce? Michelle Amy or something
Amy.
Like that.
Amy. Yeah.
Well, you know, she was about being perfect, and then on top of that, when it came time for her to really put the show on, she was fearful of being criticized and fearful of what if she didn't, you know, make the show like she's supposed to. Well, put it in our life perspective. How many of us have done that and then later on went home agitated, kicking yourself in the rear end, saying, man, what did I do that for? Why did I back out of that? Why did I make that decision? That right there will cause TMS, will it not? And you pile that up with 100 of those cases. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it builds, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It's self-reinforcing. And once you get a bad rap inside, it's like, yeah, I can remember having to go live on stage and play. And back in the green room and just being sick, just having to go back and throw up. I couldn't stand going out on stage. But once I was out there, then another person took over. But still, that's the bad feeling you have about yourself, like you're unworthy, that you're not good enough. It can make you really try hard, too, that divided mind.
Well, I got one more question from the first chapter, and then we'll go to the second chapter. Is that okay with y'all?
Sure.
Okay. It's basically about Tiger Woods, you know? I mean, look how he goes out. He's probably hit a million golf balls in his lifetime, you know, and he's worked on this every day. I think he's already made himself like the best golfer in the world. But Steve's case is he's really no different than the woman that sits and scrubs floors 10 hours a day. And with this, she's down here cleaning the kitchen floor 100 times a day with an OCD disorder. She'd be considered neurotic. But, you know, and then you got Tiger Woods out there, and he's, you know, staying on the golf field. And we understand why, because he's a pro at it, and that's what he does. But my question would be, how many of us, you know, in the past have caught ourselves, you know, staying on something 10, 12, 13 hours just to make sure it's done perfect, make sure no matter what, it's going to be done perfect, you know, or maybe even stay on a project just in order to keep from being confronted in situations. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, when Steve contrasts the woman who cleans her floor 1,000 times with OCD versus Tiger Woods, he says that they do have a lot in common. They share a lot of the same traits and motivations, but he says the diagnosis of neurosis can be highly subjective. And then he asks the question, is the goal socially rational? I guess being the world's best golfer is socially rational. But cleaning your floor 1,000 times loses its purpose, its social purpose.
I mean, it's both sound equally useless to me.
Yeah, I remember in the past, just all day long, I would go and work, you know, 14, 15 hours a day. I would spend a long time on maybe a 2 or 3 hour job. I would spend 14, 15 hours on it just to make sure it was perfect. And I'd got my mind in a place where a lot of times I just couldn't get away from whatever I was doing. I just wanted it to be perfect. And I remember in the past, you know, reading Steve's book tonight, I remember in the past a lot of times. And then when I would walk from the project, I would be so full of anxiety, Bruce, because I still didn't think it was good enough. And now I know to pay attention to that. And not to have that reaction. But in the past, it was really anxiety prone that sometimes I just couldn't seem to get certain things good enough. So I would say that was neurotic, huh?
Yep. The neuroses They're all around us. This is the modern age.
Yeah. I think a lot of us, you know, has had that once, at least once in our lives, huh? What about you, Tennis Tom? Are you there? What about you, Forrest? What have you done over and over and over a million times, and then later on come to find out you didn't have to do that much? You were just doing it. Go ahead.
I think it's you know, it's probably lots of little things.
The little stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you know, again, this is what I'm saying. To the times, you know, before we learned about TMS and what we went through. Okay, does anybody want to collaborate?
Collaborate
on the overdoing things. TMSing is what I call it.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Well, has anyone ever had to clean up the house before they started a project? That's at its simplest form, where you have to clean the floors in order to be able to write the paper.
Yeah, I like that. Like, I have to shower before I exercise. My wife or my fiance always asks me, why do I shower before I exercise? She says, why don't you do it afterwards? I'm like, well, I have to shower before I exercise. That's just something I got to do, which I don't think that's neurotic right there. But in the past, I would take 7 or 8 showers a day. So,
wow.
You know, it was just... I was a rascal.
Yeah,
I didn't let people sweat on me.
You're getting into that territory.
You know?
But yeah, I think
that's
like
neurotic.
That. We all have little things like that.
Yeah.
All day long. You know, you got to do it in this order.
I think paying attention to the reaction at the time, you know, and getting that reaction under control is, over time, will be the cure to that. Do y'all agree? You know what I mean by the reaction to it? The reaction is you keep doing it over and over and over again. The order is to get control of that reaction and over time, you know, stop it. Okay. Well, we'll go to the highly sensitive people. I think there's a lot of those on the phone.
Yeah.
I know I am. I mean, I'll be the first one to say I'm a highly sensitive person, and I've been working on it for probably 13 years now. Go ahead, Bruce.
Well, if Chapter 20 is Steve's attempt to link the TMS personality with a neurosis as defined by Jung and Hornet, the Chapter 21 that deals with highly sensitive people, or HSPs, is linked to Elaine N. Aaron's book, The Highly Sensitive Person. And he begins, the type T chronic symptom sufferer is an extremely aware or sensitive personality. What many would consider as simple things bother highly sensitive people, HSPs, or somatically sensitive. They take criticism more personally and will dig deeper caves to avoid confrontation. I have known people who try to avoid all people because they were once criticized by one person. It hurt them deeply enough that they dropped out of social relationships altogether. If the avoidance of social life isn't enough protection, they often turn to self-numbing counterforces, antidepressants, and more glasses of courage. That sounds like the British poet Lionel Johnson, who spent all his time drinking gin and no one knew it. But I thought the most interesting part of this chapter was on the last page, where Steve talks about ways your HSP trait affects your medical care. That's good concrete stuff. He says you're more sensitive to bodily signs and symptoms. Yes. If you don't lead a life suited to your trait, you'll develop more stress-related and or psychosomatic illnesses. You're always accommodating. You're more sensitive to medications. You're more sensitive to pain. You'll be more aroused, usually over aroused, by medical environments, procedures, examinations, and treatments. Yeah, say that again. In healthcare environments, your deep intuition cannot ignore the shadowy presence of suffering and death, the human condition in the background like in an examining room in a hospital. Given all of the above, the fact that most mainstream medical professionals are not HSPs, your relationships with them are usually more problematic. So that's what this chapter is about, how hypersensitive people react to situations, medical situations, differently than, I guess, your alpha type or your beta type. Does that open a can of worms for anybody?
Yeah, you mentioned there you'll be more aroused, usually over-aroused, by the medical environments, procedures, examinations, and treatments. I made it a thing in my past not to go to too many doctors, because I did get over-aroused real bad when I was 15 years old. A doctor looked down my throat and gave me this nocebo that I was going to die. So from that time forth, I didn't really care to go to the doctors anymore. I suffered through a lot of pain, and I'm glad that happened like that, because at the same time I was young-minded, and from not going to the doctors, I kept myself from back surgery. But anyway, all things lead out to the good when we look that way, right? But anyway, let me go back to this. When he said that to me, it just set off something on the inside of me, a fear that you know, somebody tells you you're dying, you get this fear, wow. And I was just a 15-year-old kid, and then I'm looking at, wow, I've not even to live my life, you know, and I'm already going to die. Of course, it was an nocebo. The man didn't know what he's talking about. He never ran a test on me or nothing. Come to find out, I had strep throat. And I live, thank God, because I got to a doctor that knew what he was talking about. But this is the point. We go to these doctors, and when they say things to us, and I'm talking about in the past, and we'd go to the doctors, and they'd say things to us, we'd be hanging every word that they would be saying. And if they said something good, we felt good. If they said something bad, we felt bad. How many on the phone's been through that? You know what I mean?
Do you mean by we TMSers in general?
Yeah.
We're more susceptible to suggestion, auto-suggestion as well. That's that imaginative component. Yeah, well, what I've noticed with the hospital environments is before my mother died, I always trusted them. And now I notice when I'm in a big time medical environment in a hospital, I do not react well. Not like I used to. I used to accept their judgment. Something fundamentally changed. No doubt, on a very deep level because of her death in a hospital. Mm-hmm. Before that, I was, you know, I trusted the doctors. I listened to the diagnoses. Well, I had a really good one too. I didn't really fall into the maw of the medical establishment until then. But I've always wondered about that before and after. Like when I went in for a torn rotator cuff and they checked my blood pressure, it was like 160 or 170. And I thought, oh no, I've got high blood pressure now. Then I went to my old family doctor and he measured my blood pressure, 114. You don't have high blood pressure. Then I started to realize the difference. I was entering into Kaiser. I was going into one of these big hospitals. It reminded me of that fatal day that she died.
And that would bring your blood pressure up, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. And mm-hmm. there it is, separation anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Because I associate hospitals with separation from my mother through death.
Mm. Wow. Does anybody else want to collaborate on talking about maybe avoidance issues you might have had in the past, about taking criticism personally? You might have a story about that, about confrontations, feeling unproductive, feeling empty.
I'd like to say something about criticism. I absolutely hate criticism. I really do. But over the years, I've learned that if you can actually get somebody to say something honest to you, even if they're being nasty, but they're being truthful, it's actually the best thing that could happen to you. I mean, I can think of several different examples, and in these situations, somebody said something critical, and people don't usually say critical things to me because I'm pretty mouthy, and so it's often not a good idea to be openly aggressive with me. But anyway, once in a while, somebody does it anyway, and of course, I always think, oh, you know, silly old jerk or whoever, you know, and I don't, you know, and I sort of get mad at that person. But honestly, it kind of plays in my mind, and I think about it, and I think, you know, I guess they've got a point there. And it takes me a few months to process it, but I usually find that whatever they said was very useful. I still don't like them much, maybe.
I think Michael Brown says in the presence process that we're in our unenlightened state, we're confronted by all of these negative people who come into our environment and they criticize us and we react because of our, I guess, our neuroses and our childhood upbringing. But he says if you wipe that slate clean and see this criticism in a constructive way for what it is, you'll always be learning things from that if you don't react. If you just see what kind of message they're bearing to you.
If they're just being nasty,
yes.
If what they're saying is true, it's actually very useful.
Yeah, I think when someone is open enough to actually tell you the truth and to share that honesty with you, it's almost a gift. It's not a gift that you really want to get, but it's a nice thing. It's a generous thing.
It's a gift, yeah. But I mean, usually there's a way to say it that isn't critical.
Yeah. But,
you know, sometimes someone will just snap out a criticism I've come to appreciate it, but I don't want them doing it more than once every decade because it really gets, you know, it gets me upset and I want to, you know, smack them and stuff. But
that's what they do in acting studios in Hollywood where they're actually turning somebody out from like little theater or off Broadway, and they take them out to LA. They assign them a name actor who knows this stuff, and he just tears them apart in private. And that's the way they come out being good actors like Brando or somebody of that caliber, because they have to be torn to pieces first and then reconstruct themselves honestly. But it's in that intimate environment in the acting studio where everybody lets their defenses down and just gets down to business and work. It must be a horrendously devastating experience to go through if you think you're hot from off Broadway and they tell you, no, you've been doing it all wrong. This is the way to do it. And you've got to accept it because these guys are better than you are. I knew a guy who was paired with Robert Moriarty from off-Broadway, where he was in the soaps for a while, and then he went into his acting studio, and he said it was devastating because he thought he was hot. He thought he was good. And then a pro told him, but he had to accept it because that's what made him better, made him good, just the way it is in those kind of environments with professionals. You got to get all that kid stuff out. You got to get rid of that kid stuff.
I was going to read this one passage, not a question or anything, but I was just going to read the passage because to me, this sums up what the two chapters are about and about how to get moving on with your life. He says, this is at the bottom of page 243 from chapter 21. He says, pain serves as a message. It was the messenger that let Marcellus, and Marcellus is some guy he's talking about here, that let Marcellus know that he was unhappy. He began reflecting on his life and decided to start anew. One small step at a time, he became reflective, more spiritually aware. He also did what Dr. Sarno said was possibly the most important thing of all. He became much more active. A year or more later, it happened, as Marcellus explained in Guidepost, I woke one Sunday morning with the strangest sensation. Nothing hurt, the pain in my back gone. Same with my right leg and my left hand. Today, Marcellus is a personal fitness trainer who helps other people get their lives back into shape. This is him quoted, and listen to what he tells them. I couldn't have dreamed up a better job. You should hear me push my clients. It's not about the pain, I tell them. It's about rebuilding your body, rebuilding your health, rebuilding your life. You can do it, I know. And we're going to end it on that right there, because that's what it's about, you know, rebuilding your, it's not about the pain, it's about rebuilding your life and getting back to relationship with life. And I think that pretty much sums it up. Would y'all agree?
I think so. What a beautiful quote.
All right.
Yeah, that is a good story.
Okay, well, we'll end it on that, and that's the end of the recording, the end of the show. So next week it'll be on to chapters 22 and 23. Thank you very much.